Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's Thursday, March 14th, and I'm going to follow the order of the agenda, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 302. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 302 transfers duties, functions, and powers from the State Board of Psychologist Examiners, Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, State Board of Licensed Social Workers, Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists, State Board of Examiners for Speech Pathology and Audiology, State Board of Chiropractic Examiners, Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine, Medical Imaging Board, State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. Has an operative date of January 1, 2014. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. There's been a lot of reaction to this bill, and I want to start from the get-go that there's some really good ideas in it, and it's obviously going to be an ongoing conversation. I'd like to call forward George Naughton and Gary Blackmer.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'll start. This bill...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. For the record, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the Director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. This bill is in some ways related to an audit that we conducted and issued last June on boards and commissions in general in Oregon. And I would like to give you a very brief overview of what that audit and some of its conclusions and findings are, just so that you have a little bit more context about at least an element of this. Let me see if I can get this set up here. So from our standpoint, we saw a large number of boards, over 250 boards in the state of Oregon. A large number of them, about 125 of them, are advisory boards. About 50 of them are governing boards, 40 are licensing, 20 policy, and about 10 are what we call judgment or adjudication type boards. And some of them oversee major agencies. Some of them have no staff at all and depend upon agencies to provide administrative services of various sorts. Some of them have considerable power over thousands of employees, distributing money for highway projects, deciding on how money will be invested, overseeing the state pension system or Oregon Lottery. And what we saw when we started looking at a little bit of the history was that this is an issue that has come up repeatedly over the years around how to govern and manage boards. And we ran across some rather interesting quotes from previous governors. I won't read the whole one, but in 1897, Oregon Governor William Lord said, "A board is a mischievous administrative instrumentality because its effect is to divide responsibility, destroy the symmetry of our governmental system, trench on the prerogatives of the executive, and injuriously affect the management of the institutions." He was, at that point, talking about 16 boards. We now have, we counted 269 boards, so I don't know what he would have said for 269 boards, but it has been a recurring issue in Oregon, as well as other states, that boards seem to proliferate. From an audit standpoint, we see that there are administrative and budgetary burdens that fall on the agencies when there is no staff to that board, and oftentimes they're expected to just absorb those costs. But there are also other financial, legal, and operational risks that some of those boards create if they happen to be governing an agency or in terms of licensing as well. So there are those kinds of risks that occur. But we also saw other things. When we look back at some of our audits and audits in other jurisdictions, we saw that the boards that have small staff numbers, they tend to have financial risks. We've done audits where we found that misappropriation of funds occurred because they didn't have the checks and balances of a larger staff. And we also saw that board members might not be aware of their responsibility to make sure that those staff members followed state procurement, payroll, other rules and requirements. And also, to the degree that those boards got information from the director without necessarily having a deep understanding of the operations, they didn't necessarily know about the effectiveness of the organization. So I mentioned we've done a number of audits, Commission for the Blind, the State Marine Board, the Landscape Architecture Board, the Tourism Commission, where we've been called in because of financial problems of some sort or another. And that is kind of one of those risks that seems to happen a little more with smaller boards. And so from our standpoint, we looked at the boards in general to see if there were things that we could recommend out of this audit. But all of these issues that we found were more around compliance issues, complying with state personnel or payroll or procurement rules are the things where we found violations, but we've really not done any performance audits of the boards and how well they're serving the public. So we are undertaking an audit now, and we're looking at what we think are some of the higher risk boards to see how well they're doing. And so we've selected the area of health licensing. So we're going to be looking at those boards. We're going to probably try and get a broad overview of the dozen or so that are in that category outside of the Oregon Health Licensing Administration and just see, you know, how they're managing. But we'll probably do that with one or two boards in more detail, but at least be able to get an understanding and some level of assessment of risk for those as well on a performance level, meaning are their certification processes consistent? Are their complaint processes available, timely, and fair in terms of resolution?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Have you picked your targets yet?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no, we haven't. What we'll do is we'll start with probably about 12 or 14 of the boards and get a little better understanding of each of them and what they do, and then pick one or two and look at those. And if we see that we need to do more, we would do that in a subsequent audit.
So. Okay. What is your time frame?
We are just beginning it now, so I suspect it'll be about the end of the year before we get through all of those. We're hoping we can get through the overview by June and then start looking at a couple of those subsequent to that.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'd suggest that we have report backs during our interim days because to help inform something we might want to look at for 14. So,
and that would be right. September or December.
Yeah.
Okay,
or
I'll keep that in mind.
Okay.
And what we came up with in our audit were a number of recommendations, and we recognize that this is a shared problem, that it's not just the governors that were complaining, that the legislators as well play a role in it, and DAS as well. They've had a key role over the years in terms of assisting boards in terms of their practices and procedures. So our recommendations were to all three of those, that they ensure clear authority and expectations of each board, ensure all board members receive adequate training on administrative, legal, and operational requirements, require periodic reports about each board's mission, objectives, resources, activities, and results, implement a clearly defined publicly available process for complaint handling about boards, and periodically review boards that could be eliminated or consolidated. There's a lot more in our audit report. In fact, we identify strategies other states have used to contain or reduce the number of boards. California and Washington are neighbors that have done some interesting work in that area. One of the other things is we compiled at the back of our report, there's about 60 pages of tables of each and every one of the boards and commissions in Oregon that we were able to find. And I know the governor's office has found a few more since our audit was completed. So it was an inventory that had not been done recently. And looking through statutes, talking to people in agencies, we identified a large number of boards that had not really they had known that they existed even. So to the degree that was an indication of a problem in terms of the proliferation, I think it was a great example, but it's also a good starting point to see how all those boards operate. That's the end of my testimony. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Let's go ahead and hear from the next panelist.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton. I work with the Department of Administrative Services. I operate as the state's chief financial officer. We are actually in neutral on Senate Bill 302. There's a number of issues that have been raised here. I was asked by the governor's office to come and provide just some context from our perspective about how this works. As you see from Mr. Blackmer's testimony, Oregon has a long history of operating with boards and commissions, and there are about four major ways that you can do this. You can attach these small boards and run them the way that they currently are as separate state agencies. You can attach them to a larger state agency, like the former Department of Commerce that we used to have, where a lot of these boards were inside of those as one entity. There's a third option that is the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, which I think this bill alludes to. And then finally, a fourth option is to actually move them to semi-independence. All of them are a balance between the amount of oversight and efficiency that occurs and the autonomy of the board and its responsiveness to its actual client base, which is the licensees and the public. So that's the competing interests they're flowing on this. The governor's office has been open to this conversation. This is something that comes up on a routine basis, and there's been numerous studies over the years on this topic. I think Senate Bill 302 is one of those options. The governor's office is not necessarily tied into any one of them specifically, but this really does need to be an interbranch conversation because it's not just a matter between the governor's office or the legislature. This really is a structural issue. It's a management issue for how we operate with them, and it's also a budgetary issue. One of the things that Mr. Blackmer points out is the lack of training. We used to have resources where the governor's office would provide training for new board and committee members, and those are things that have been cut over the years. So this really is a multifaceted problem, and I guess the governor's office would like you to know that they're open to the conversation. Senate Bill 302 is one of those options. The governor is not necessarily wedded to any one of those, but does think that we need to start a dialogue and have a forum for that discussion. With that, Madam Chair, I'm completed.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz. Yeah,
I think the same offer to the governor's office as to the Secretary of State's office. This is a bigger issue, and we need to be looking more comprehensively, and so we would like dialogue and input as we move forward. Clearly, I don't think this is an issue we can fix in the next couple months. Mm-hmm. So,
I am very interested in looking at efficiencies. I'm especially interested in outcome-based commissions and boards. I mean, what is their mission and what are they really doing and helping serve Oregonians? So in your audit, are you going to have addressing that issue or just give me a little more specific?
Madam Chair, at this point, the two areas that we are most concerned about is to ensure that quality practitioners are certified, that they've met all the requirements, and secondly, that if there are complaints that arrive or indications that someone is not meeting professional expectations, that those are investigated to determine their validity or not, and appropriate actions are taken. So those are the two areas that we, at least preliminarily, are thinking about, with the idea that focusing on the health licensing, which is dealing with people, you know, their bodies or they're vulnerable in other ways, so that we can ensure that the public is getting the best service from the best professionals. So that's how we start our audit, with something broad like that.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Blackmore, I haven't had a chance to read the entire report, although I've pulled it up on my iPad now, and I've got it on my reading list, so I will be. I note with some dismay the history that you give about how many times it's been under other governors, it's been attempted to consolidate or eliminate duplicative boards and commissions and think about ways to make them more efficient and how ineffective those attempts have been. What do you think the biggest barrier, do you have a sense from your work about what the biggest barriers were in those previous attempts and how we can avoid running into those barriers or overcome those barriers this time?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I like to divide it up into policy and management. And I think when Mr. Naughton talked about the getting close to the stakeholders and interest groups is one way. Looking at it from an efficiency and effectiveness is another. I'm hoping there's ways that we can actually address those distinctly, in the sense that there are practical managerial things that have to be done right that improve compliance with state rules and laws, as well as performance, which is a different notion than being responsive to the community that you're serving. And I think you can do both, but to me, the issue around managerial is that it's practical, it's good management, which you do regardless of how close or far you are from your stakeholders. So I guess I think the idea about the administration of the services is a very different notion than the association with the stakeholders. And many of these boards are trying to do both, and they may be able to separate those out in some way. That would be off the top of my head how I would try to approach that.
I apologize, Madam Chair. Thank you. I think those are really important points, Mr. Blackmer. I guess I don't want to focus too much on the past, but those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it, right? And so what I'd like to understand is, how is that strategy, for example, different than strategies that have been tried under previous administrations, of which you list four or five that have tried a similar thing, and how can we, I mean, it's scary to think that a board that you believe in and that you're on is potentially going to be eliminated. And we're doing a lot of that in the state right now, most of it for the good. I mean, just big systemic change, and that's scary. So is there somewhere in this report thoughts about how do we manage that change? How do we learn from the lessons of previous failures so that we don't repeat those and do have a better chance of succeeding, creating the kinds of boards and commissions in the state that actually are highly functional and effective and meet those points that you quite rightly outlined?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, frankly, from a risk standpoint, I think that we have a much smaller number of boards that we need to worry about, that it really is the licensing and governing boards, which are less than 100. They're the ones that have the employees to them. Policy and advisory boards, they don't necessarily have the exposure of risk of problems that those others do. So to a certain degree, I think we could reduce the risk on the administrative and managerial side and still preserve the boards. So it's not necessarily eliminating them, it's eliminating the risk and problems that go with it.
Okay, thank you. I certainly have heard from a lot of boards and commissions that came to me. Not very many are testifying, but then I said that this bill probably will not move this session, but it is definitely a topic that we need to pursue. The complaints I'm hearing from the various boards is we want our own autonomy. We don't want an overall executive director telling us how to manage our board. We want to control the fees and finances. If we want to raise the fees, we like the process that is now. We do not want the executive director of the licensing board to be a vote on the board. I mean, they went on and on those issues. And I didn't see that those issues that we would be usurping their authority at all. And so I think there are a lot of misconceptions. I think sharing of staff and administrative work, making sure that complaints from the public are being followed up in a timely manner and having staffing to do that, is so critical in making sure that the boards function. And that I see. And so from your audit, you should be able to figure out which boards do have proper staffing, are able to follow up with complaints in an expeditious manner. So am I off on this?
Madam Chair, I agree entirely. And let me use your example of the fee setting. I think it's in the purview of the board to set the fees, but they can have a shared fee collection function where, you know, the money is brought in, it's accounted for properly, there are proper controls over it, and it's distributed to each of those boards for their costs and their membership, or however the money is to be used in terms of training or other things. So to the degree that those are separate functions, that one is a decision-making and governance issue, and the other is a simple administrative or managerial function, we would say you've reduced the risk if you have good controls in place. And if a board or a commission has only three employees, there's simply no way that they can collect that cash and provide the proper oversight that we expect as auditors, that it will be independently counted and accounted for.
Any other comments? We may bring you up later, but thank you very much. And I'd like to call Wendy Borg, Oregon Psychological Association, and Dave Reinhardt. Have Dave. And then, yeah.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm a psychologist in private practice in Oregon, and I'm also the legislative chairperson of Oregon Psychological Association. We have been...
And state your name.
Oh, Dr. Wendy Borg, B-O-U-R-G. We've been following Senate Bill 302 with great interest. We've had some conversations with the governor's office. Our board has had some struggles over the past couple of years. We are very interested in getting behind a reform effort and perhaps working with other mental health associations to help with a coalition behind some bills. We're not able to support Senate Bill 302 as written. As we see it, the board has several functions. It has an administrative function. It has an investigative function. And then it has the licensing function that protects the public. What we are in favor of is shared administrative function, perhaps shared investigative function, but retaining the protection of the public within a separate jurisdiction, because it is our members with our training that understand what we do and how to keep what is good practice, what is ethical practice, and how to make sure the public is safe.
Thank you. Stay put there.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. Dave Reinhardt representing the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers. The organization's president wished he could be here today, but he had a packed schedule of clients that prevented him from doing so. I know there's been a lot of conversation about this bill and consternation about this bill, and I notice very few are testifying in opposition, and I guess that means our boards will be selected for the audits by Gary. Nevertheless,
ours already has been.
Well, we do applaud what appear to be the goals of SB 302. We've been told that it was designed to spark a conversation on Oregon's boards and commissions, and we're happy to join in that conversation, if only to point out that the State Board of Licensed Social Workers does not appear to be one of the problem boards or commissions, and also to point out that we are from our standpoint, OSCSW's standpoint, we're very happy with the management and the conduct of the board. SB 302 appears to be designed to consolidate administrative functions in the process, and in the process save money, and we're not opposed to that. That's a noble goal. Who's against saving a few bucks and eliminating some redundancy? But this is a complex bill, at least it reads that way to those of us who've read it all. It appears to go beyond a simple administrative consolidation. It removes about, as we read it, it removes about 90% of the Board of Licensing Social Workers' powers. The board would retain its role in formulating policy regarding licensure standards and ethics codes, But the social workers board would give up any role in interpreting licensing standards, applying the social work ethics codes, or actually meting out discipline to wayward professionals. Those tasks would be left to the new Oregon Health Licensing Agency. In short, SB 302 would end decades of the social work profession's ability to connect the expertise of the profession with the application of licensing standards, regulatory outcomes of the profession. We don't think that we're overreacting, but our view is that this mega consolidation would be bad for clinical social workers and other licensed professionals in the mental health area, particularly, and this is key, particularly at a time when there is such stir and change in the healthcare arena. At the very least, the proposal would make it hard to find good appointees to the Board of Clinical Social Workers. After all, who wants to serve on an essentially neutered board? I think you'd have a hard time finding people that would take away from their busy schedule to do that. Fortunately, we join with the psychologists in thinking there's a way to achieve all of Senator Johnson or the administration's goals in the mental health arena. And we're grateful that the senator has shown herself to be more than willing to consider this approach. Rather than throwing all nine boards together, one approach would be to start by, say, turning the three mental health boards, psychologists, examiners, the Board of Licensed Counselors and Therapists, and the Board of Licensed Clinical Social Workers, into a combined Office of Behavioral Health and Social Work Licensure. Such an approach would achieve administrative consolidation, including the elimination of two director positions, and encourage the integration of computer, investigative, and other administrative systems. At the same time, it would retain a strategic focus at all staff levels on behavioral health and social work in service of boards that actually make decisions or continue to make decisions. We think this kind of pilot program would serve as a way to show what can be done elsewhere. Maybe the problem in all those years of worrying about boards and commissions that extend back to the 1890s is a result of tackling this situation in a large mega way instead of just a gradualist approach. In the end, there are a lot of issues for you to consider. We're happy to consider them with you and look forward to working with the other organizations in doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Stay put for a moment, because there's only one more, Janice Krim, and then I will want to address all three of you since you represent the boards.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janice Krim. I'm an attorney. I've practiced for over 35 years. This practice is exclusively focused on administrative law. I'm a former administrative law judge. The administrative law section on behalf of the Oregon State Bar has no objection. We are not here with any concern about the consolidation efforts. That is not our issue whatsoever. However, our focus is on a very simple issue, a very hugely important issue to us, which is Section 6.2 of the bill. The language remains the same, but the impact of it is huge because it affects now 20 boards instead of the original boards. And the effect it has is to basically place barriers up so that people who have a concern with the agency can no longer request contested case hearings in practice because of the economic impact that this bill has on that process. This is a one-sided assessment. The board can basically assess their costs against a licensee. The licensee does not have a reciprocal responsibility. Section 6, subsection 2. Does that help?
I'm looking at it, I'm just not seeing exactly how that does what you say it does, but I may be missing something.
Let me demonstrate how...
Is it page 5, lines 4 through 7?
I don't have the 133-page bill here, so
I'm just trying to make sure I'm following you, because I think you're...
I think it's on page 5 of the bill I have printed.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yep.
I don't have the whole bill, so I wasn't sure. I've already submitted the written testimony. I won't go into that. I'd just like to give you a practical implication of how this actually works in practice. Anyone can have a complaint filed against them, and that sets up a review by the agency, as it should. That's not our issue. Our issue is, how does it work when you have a provision like Section 6.2 implementing itself in the middle of this process? When a licensee comes to my office and says, I didn't do this, I have a complaint filed against them, I have to explain to them how this system works. The first thing I say is that the agency writes the final order. They find the facts, they make the decision. And they can impose against you the cost of the proceeding. That means that you will pay for, licensee, you will pay for your investigation, your employee time, your attorney's fees, the attorney's fees for your employees should they need an attorney. You will eat all of the costs to defend yourself in this proceeding, and if the agency issues a final order, they can then make you pay for all of their costs, all of their attorney's fees. And when they say to me, and if I win, can I recover? My answer to them is said, no, you may not. This is one-sided. This is really not just a budget issue. This is really a fairness issue. A contested case hearing, which is what allows someone to make the agency take a second look, is being derailed and deterred by the economics of this. I'm here to say that it is probably true, as the agencies may tell you, that when they impose these costs on a wrongdoer, that they should be punished. My response to that, as a practitioner in this area, is that you're not just punishing wrongdoers. You are preventing people who have never been heard from ever getting a chance to be heard. You are punishing people who deserve a chance to defend themselves against a complaint. This provision makes it economically impossible for them to proceed and take the risk of not winning or even the effort it takes to pursue a contested case hearing. We urge you, if this bill should move out of committee, to delete Section 6.2 and the agencies that it applies to.
Thank you very much.
Do you have any questions?
No, but what I do want to say, since these are the only ones that have been signed up to testify, that I believe that a work group, or at least maybe in the making, and so I assume that every board that's been here, two of you, and then everyone else, will maybe be a part of a process to get your input on where your concerns are for your boards, where you can see consolidation working, administrative issues, financial issues, staffing issues, etc. So I really do laud the intent of the bill, but I do think that we have some work to do on it. Any other comments? All right, so I don't plan to hear this bill again unless I hear the stakeholders for the bill to come forward, but I do believe that there will be an ongoing process to look at how we can make government more efficient. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, okay, we might invite the boards to self-audit and send us their recommendations, and then we could weigh that against the Secretary of State's recommendations and the Governor's recommendations.
That's right. Excellent suggestion. All right. Yes.
Given Senator Cruz's suggestion, and that those boards are all under the purview of one Ways and Means Subcommittee or another because of their budgets, I wonder if we should think about engaging our colleagues who sit on those various Ways and Means Subcommittees because they have the authority to put budget notes in and things like that, if we think that that's a useful way to proceed.
That may be a little early, but...
No, but I mean, yeah. As part, you know, when we get to that point in the process, that's another way that we can help engage the boards in helping us sort this out.
You know some people on the subcommittee, don't you?
All right, with that, I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 302. And we have the next four bills that all are Department of Human Service bills. And so I'm going to open all of them up, and then we are going to, so that when you come up, when I call your name, you first talk about whatever bill. Identify yourself and then say which bill you're referring to, and that way we'll have not the same people coming up all the time. Okay, so Mike Maley from...
Open first there.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay, I close Senate Bill public hearing on 302, and I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 559, Senate Bill 564, Senate Bill 640, and Senate Bill 641.
Very well.
All right, and now I would like to ask Mike Maley.
My friend. My friend.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Maley. I'm the Deputy Director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services in the Department of Human Services. And I'll be testifying on three of the four bills. The first one, Senate Bill 564, and then Senate Bill 640 and 641. And I've got a handout, or the written testimony, and I'll go through that as briefly as I can. Senate Bill 564 really addresses the what are called adult support services for individuals with developmental disabilities, and those are the services that were developed as a part of the Staley lawsuit settlement several years ago, developed the brokerages, and then were codified by House Bill 2600 at the last full session in 2011. So the provisions and kind of the vehicle of providing those services are in statute, and those are the statutes that this bill specifically addresses. And the bill does three things from our perspective, and they're outlined in the written testimony. The first, it adds some language to the definition of support services. And then it talks about a strategy of the use of those support services by adding conditions in which they can be expanded beyond what is the current practice. And then it requires the bill to take passage upon, or takes effect upon passage. The first comment is just probably a minor one, but the expanded definition really says that the support services are intended to keep somebody in their own home. And yes, that is one perspective, but support services are intended to be much broader than that in terms of helping people be fully engaged in their communities through employment, through recreation, through contribution, all of those things. And to be perfectly candid, from the my understanding of the bill, I don't think that's the intent behind it in terms of limiting, you know, the perspective of what support services are. I don't believe that. I think it was just a wording thing that could be construed that way from a reader. So we just wanted to point that out. But the major provision is Section 2.7. And in essence, that is a concept that is very important to the Office of Developmental Disability Services and the Department. It is, in fact, a concept that's fully embedded in our sustainability plan. And that plan is really rooted in the concept that we need to do everything we can as a system to support people in their own homes, in their own communities, in a more robust way than what we're currently, you know, doing it. Because if we can be successful in doing that, we avoid individuals with developmental disabilities going into higher cost out-of-home services. And that's been a cornerstone of that sustainability plan since its inception, and it's been discussed publicly. There's been several presentations to interim committees of the legislature, and it was discussed within the last 2 hours, before the at the Ways and Means presentation by our office. So it's an important concept. The reason I wanted to bring that up is that we have been working on that already. There is a stakeholder work group that's been working on a way to take our support services and expand their use. So, forgive my use of my hands, that's the only way I can make the presentation, but what we basically have is a kind of a hole in our system where the support services, the in-home services, are capped, and if that capped benefit isn't sufficient, then somebody could jump to a much higher level need. So the idea is to expand that so we fill in that difference. And that is what we believe this bill is saying. Our point is we have been working on that. We have a stakeholder group that's been working on that, developing the policies, the procedures, and the practice to make that work. And that work group is in fact overseen by a larger stakeholder group. So this piece is in practice. I think one of the concerns that we bring forward, just from a wording of the bill says it's just based on cost. Well, there's other factors other than cost in terms of making those kinds of decisions, and that's what the work group is addressing. The third piece is implementation upon passage of the bill. These are the kinds of activities that take testing and training and IT, changes in payment systems and all of that to implement. So to do that kind of immediately, is kind of mechanically very, very difficult. So looking at the timing of the implementation would also be useful.
Before you go further, Senator Devlin, and has Representative Buckley come in yet?
No.
But, yes.
Madam Chair, I would prefer to wait.
Okay. All right.
Kind of
as soon as Representative Buckley comes in, then we'll just have you
stop.
Stay and then have them testify. All right.
Okay. And so anyway, that is my testimony for Senate Bill 564.
Okay. Yes.
If other people have questions first, that's fine.
Yes.
Mr. Mealy, this is really helpful. I guess I have some questions about the timeline and also about the federal waivers that are required.
Yes.
Oregon has a pretty good track record getting waivers for things like this, but have other states received similar waivers? Are we in the process of asking for waivers like this? Do you have a sense of how that process might go? I know we're asking for this other K waiver right now. And
yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Haywood, the process can be lengthy in terms of there are specific timelines and mechanics that have to go into the process. So once we submit it, there's a 90-day clock that starts, that type of thing. And yes, there have been other states in recent years that have some similar types of waivers as this support waiver. This concept is embedded in the waiver, and it's actually a growing wave of program design across the countries. I couldn't tell you the specific number.
Could I ask a quick follow-up, please? So that being said, is your work group learning, getting information from those other states so you don't have to reinvent the wheel and sort of taking the pieces of those things that would work for Oregon, because they may be very different from other states?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Haywood, I don't think we have done much research with other states. I think that the concept here is we have a structure that seems to be working. It's just that the limits that we've placed on it, seem to cause a problem, an inadvertent problem, in terms of having people go to services that are probably more costly than what they need. So we want to just prevent that from happening, but we want to make sure that how those mechanics work, are kind of proper for the situation.
Okay, could I trouble you for one more follow-up?
That's okay.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, let's proceed with the different bills because I do want to have the constituents and the proponents of the bill go forward.
Are we looking at I mean, we drew lines. We have the different levels, and are we looking at level adjustments as well here, or?
Yes, we're making the level adjustment. The plan is to make the level adjustment up, so more people can be served within the current structure without having to leave that structure into a
home. Do you have a clue what level?
Right now, the average cost for the comprehensive services, which are the more, is around, you know, $6,000 a month, something like that.
Right,
but it's going to vary by type of service because there's different types.
Right, right.
So that's the benchmark that we're trying to go into now between the current level, which is about $21,000 a year. So whatever that is divided by 12 to that higher. So it's within that range that we're going to be working.
I see that Representative Buckley is here now, and so I have opened all four bills, and so I would like you to come forward, Senator Devlin and Representative Buckley, and just set aside, let them give their testimony, and then we'll...
You know, they're starting to actually look alike now.
This is what reality looks like.
You recognize... Madam Chair, members of the committee, you're insulting him, not me.
I wasn't insulting anybody.
Okay, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We are both here to appear on several bills that you've opened the hearings for. I would like to start off by just reading one sentence, and I'm going to use that as sort of the preamble.
Would you give us your name first, please?
Yes, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. These words are all familiar to all of you. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm opening with this because your discussion today is on the developmentally disabled. And just because someone is developmentally disabled does not mean that they should not enjoy all the rights that the citizens of this great country enjoy, or that they should be empowered to have all the expectations that citizens have. What we're going to be talking to you today is about some bills that we will think will help people have more choices, be able to live better lives, and perhaps have some right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The four bills before you today are SB 559, SB 564, SB 640, and SB 641. They are part of a legislative package to improve services to Oregonians with developmental disabilities. Taken together, these bills have a simple goal: to create a system of centered on the principles of self-determination and independent living, the ability to pursue competitive and supportive employment, and the opportunity to live a life of dignity in their own communities. Choosing where and how we live and participate in our communities are fundamental rights. SB 559 will give Oregonians with developmental disabilities a voice in choosing where they live, and provides equal opportunity in job placements. Currently, individuals who go into comprehensive services, commonly known as residential services, have little choice about where they live or receive services. The decision is largely up to the regional crisis system or the local community development disabilities program. SB 559 will require that individuals be given three placement options. At least two options must be different types of settings. For example, an individual might be shown two group homes and one adult foster home. Oregonians should have a choice in where they live and who they live with. SB 559 helps them accomplish that. SB 559 also ensures that Oregonians with developmental disabilities have equal opportunity for job placements. Job placement for those seeking employment will be assigned on a first-come, first-served basis. This next bill, SB 640, improves the reassessment process for people in DD comprehensive services. Currently, individuals are reassessed once every 5 years to determine the level of support they need and funding that their service provider will receive. If a person's support needs change within the 5 years between assessments, it is very difficult to receive a reassessment of service needs. Often, service providers are forced to file an exit notice to force the county to reassess service findings. Even if the provider has no intention of following through with the exit, this process can be disruptive, and emotionally harmful to the person receiving services. SB 640 mandates that reassessments be done once every 3 years or so, or if a provider can show a documented change in condition, their client can receive a reassessment without the provider needing to threaten to give notice. SB 640 is needed to make sure that supported individuals are having their needs met without the threat of losing their provider. Before I turn it over to my good colleague, Representative Buckley, the one thing I would like to say is that we all know, we all in our histories have families, friends, associates who either have developmental disabilities, or they have people in their families, or people that they've known who have developmental disabilities. Now, 1% of the population has developmental disabilities. These are people that deserve the respect that any person deserves in this life. They should be treated as individuals. They should be treated with respect. They should be given the opportunity to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. Honored to be here with you, Senator Devlin, to introduce this package of bills. This package, in addition to Senate Bill 626, which you'll hear next week, provides critical, common sense, and cost-effective fixes to the current system. Although Oregon has made great progress in improving DD services over the past decade, there are still critical gaps that prevent Oregonians with developmental disabilities from choosing where they live and the services they receive. Senate Bill 564 builds upon the importance of self-determination by lifting the monetary cap of $21,562 on brokerage services. Now, the brokerage system is a default system for those entering into the DD service system. Supported individuals are given a personal budget based on three tiers. The base tier provides about $11,000 a year. The next tier, base plus, about $14,000 per year. An exceptional rate for those with greater needs goes up to $21,562 per year. Unfortunately, there are Oregonians whose needs cannot be met under that existing cap. These individuals move from the brokerage system into crisis and the comprehensive system, a move that often creates trauma for those individuals and their families. The average cost of comprehensive services in Oregon is $60,000 a year. SB 564 removes that current arbitrary financial cap on support services for Oregonians with developmental disabilities who want to live at home. SB 564 lets Oregonians continue to stay in their homes with support services as long as the cost of those services would be less than the cost of going into a residential setting in the comprehensive system. Preventing someone from entering crisis and the comprehensive system unnecessarily and unwillingly will save Oregon money in the long run or prevent the trauma of being forced to leave your home and your community. Senate Bill 641 provides for a uniform assessment tool and ensures that changing support needs are met for individuals in comprehensive services. Now, currently, DHS has two different assessment tools that are used. The first is the SNAP tool used for adult foster homes, and the second is SIS, Supports Intensity Scale, which is used by every other type of service, including group homes and employment services. The SIS was created by a team of experts over 5 years for the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities and measure support requirements in 57 life activities and 28 behavioral and medical areas. This tool is used in several states and countries, including New Mexico, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Taiwan, Sweden, Canada, Australia, and many others. Colorado adopted the SIS as a uniform assessment tool after CMS expressed concerns that Colorado did not have consistent processes for determining funding levels for individuals in their Medicaid waiver programs. In contrast, the SNAP tool was created by DHS staff without provider or stakeholder input. Adult foster home providers complain that the SNAP tool does not adequately assess an individual's support needs, especially individuals with higher behavioral support needs. Additionally, the SIS tool includes a process to assess an individual's exceptional medical or behavioral needs, where the SNAP tool has no such process available. Now, many individuals receiving services in adult foster homes also receive the SIS because of the employment services they receive. Oregon needs a uniform assessment tool that's based on best practices and is developed with stakeholder input, and that tool could and probably should be the SIS. Senate Bill 641 also directs the DHS to provide the person receiving the services, the service providers, family members or guardians with a service assessment that will show a detailed description of how the service rate was assessed and what services are expected to be provided. Greater transparency will prevent confusion and improve accountability in the system. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Comments? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a concern about the three placement options. When you have communities that are really small and there may not be that many options, that would be my only concern with that one. That we're putting a burden that can't be met. So just a thought as we move forward with this.
Thanks, sir.
Okay.
Just want to thank
yes.
the gentleman
yeah.
for bringing these really, really thoughtful, person-centered bills. They are exactly the kind of creative thinking that we need to be doing, and it sounds like there's some logistical issues to be sorted out, but yeah. I don't hear anybody at the moment jumping up and down and saying these are silly ideas. I think most of us think that they're great ideas. I heard about this all, as Mr. Mealy mentioned, I heard about it all 2 hours ago in Human Services Sub, and I'm really excited about this, and this is exactly what we should be doing, is getting consistent, getting evidence-based, getting patient-centered, person-centered, and I think it's terrific.
Madam Chair, I agree. I was just pointing out there may be a slight flaw for some of our communities that aren't nearly that large, and just want to make sure we aren't putting a catch-22, and having options is a great idea, but you know, I have communities that probably don't have that many options in them, so.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's a great point, and we leave in your committee's capable hands the difficulty of exploring those options and making sure it works.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And Mike, will you continue quickly on the other bill so we can get to the other testifiers?
Should I introduce myself again for the
yes,
record?
Yes, please.
Mike Mealy, Developmental Disabilities Deputy Director for the Office of or for the Department of Human Services. In terms of moving on to Senate Bill 640 and 641, some of the things that were just presented to you are part of the testimony. And just in terms of just a little bit more background to fill in perhaps some of the gaps, the Office of Developmental Disabilities did start in the year 2005 looking at assessment and rate setting tools for our major residential services, which are the foster home services that you just heard discussed, and the group home services, the 24-hour residential services. And it was a part of the, I think similar to the Colorado story, is that when you looked at it, there wasn't consistent rate setting across the state equitably for everybody involved. So that was the genesis of the piece. And so the work started in 2005, and then the tools were developed and implemented starting 2008. So we've been using the tools, the SNAP tool and the SIS tool, the Supports Intensity Scale, and the SNAP, the Support Needs Assessment Profile, for several years now. So it is an accurate statement to say that we have two tools that we're using. So and that was a conscious decision. And one of the issues, not issues, but one of the conceptual factors here, it's one thing to say, let's do an assessment. It's another to say, how do we take that information and then translate it into a rate, for a provider? Yeah, and that's, generally the trick. And when you look at group homes and foster homes, there's similarities oftentimes in terms of the people that they're serving. You would see somebody in a group home that looks somebody like somebody who served in a foster home and vice versa. But they are different models. They have different cost factors. They have different designs. So a group home, for example, are operated by generally nonprofit organizations. They are 24-hour staffed, paid staff, models. They have the administrative costs that go along with providing running an organization. A foster home, by definition, is services provided in the home of the provider, where the provider is the primary person responsible for the supports. And now they may do that in a lot of different ways, use family members to help out, do some paid support. There's just different ways to go about meeting the service. So the cost structures are, in fact, different. So in terms of the SNAP, in terms of the supports intensity scale and how that then translates into a rate, we were able to do cost studies on residential organizations, you know, in terms of what would the typical cost associated with providing services to people. You don't have that necessarily that same opportunity to do that in all of the foster homes. So the assessment and rate tool for the foster care, the SNAP, is really a tool that assesses everybody's individual needs and assigns a cost to that. You know, so it can just go right into that that money follows that person into that particular setting, where the SIS tool and the ultimate rate derived from that from a group home is based on cost studies of the organizations for serving people of similar acuity. So those are just the basic differences that went in. But the point is, it's been a process that's been going on for a while. There was lots of research, lots of testing, you know, lots of training that has gone into that. So that is the process that we are using today. So, and those are the common things between 640 and 641. There are some differences, as you heard. And again, I'll try to hurry here. But 640 is the bill that you heard just a few seconds ago that also says, in addition to the uniform rate setting tool idea, that also says that reassessments need to be done every 3 years instead of 5 years. You know, the department now has an assessment team, because all of these assessments, and I've forgotten to mention, are done by interviews of what are called key informant groups, you know, done by people who know that individual best to get to the assessment of the needs. We have a team of people, 11 people, who do all of those interviews on a regular scheduled basis, and our plan is to do that on 5 years. There is, in fact, a process in place where if issues happen, significant needs change, that there can be a reassessment done. There is a process in place already to do that based on significant needs, principally based on medical and behavioral changes. And then 641, like 640, has the uniform assessment requirement in it, but that is the bill that calls for an advisory group. If that is the direction that is required to put together an advisory group, you know, that would not be inconsistent with the practice that we have of putting together stakeholder advisory groups for these kind of major policy things. And then the final question, or the final comment or requirement, was the written notice requirement that I think Senator Devlin, I think, is the one who mentioned that. And, you know, that's a very important piece, and it does go to transparency. And the reality is, the more transparent the rates are and the mechanics that went into it and all of that is available, then the better plans can be made, the better providers know their expectations, and quite frankly, the better advocates who want to advocate for change, you know, in that structure know. So if we're somehow falling short in that, we'd certainly be willing to work with the sponsors of the bill to say, how can we further address that current questions? Because certainly transparency, you know, is an important factor, you know, for everybody in making something like this work.
Excellent.
So I'd be happy to address any questions. Okay. Sorry it took so long, but.
No, that's all right. I think we'll go ahead and thank you very much for your testimony. Any comments or questions? Not at this point in time. Okay. So let's call up Carol Conlon, Esther Rogers, and Mary Elizabeth. And I know one of you has to leave early.
Okay, so you go first.
And please introduce yourself and then state which bill specifically you're addressing.
All right, good afternoon, Chair Lawrence Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Esther Rogers, and I'm here today to urge you to support Bill 559. This bill would increase people's choices to live where they are placed comprehensive care for developmental disabilities. This bill is important to me, as I have seen the lack of choosing in housing for people with disabilities, and I've worked for Bethesda Communities for about 4.5 years as a direct support service provider. And I've seen how like fundamental human rights on how to choose to where you lived were ignored, and it had a negative effect on the individuals. For example, I'll use the name Florence for privacy reasons. Florence was very social, very verbal, and she was placed with three nonverbal individuals, and she complained about it for years. Finally, 2 years later, a capable staff came to try to help her get placed in another home, and she was told that she had to wait, and she ended up waiting like 4 years before she was placed in a home where she could be social. During that time, she had very self-destructive behaviors and a lot of really severe depression issues and self-doubt. And finally, fortunately, she moved to another home and with social people, and her behaviors dramatically just stopped. And she's very happy there. And I've just seen the difference. She doesn't have to just talk to staff. And if she had been given a choice, she wouldn't choose to live in a home with nonverbal people. And if she didn't have to wait to be moved, that would, and she had a choice in where to move instead of just waiting for an opening, and she had a choice, that would have improved her life, her quality of care. Then I have another story of somebody I will call Judy, and again, for privacy reasons, that's not her name. She lived in a group home with somebody she really did not like, and she would be very destructive and very verbal behaviors, and became increasingly negative. Several employees complained on behalf of Judy because they saw the negative results of her and her not being able to move to where she wanted to move or move the staff where nothing was done for years. And finally, the staff member moved, and it's taken about a year and a half, and finally now her behaviors are getting better, and she sings now where she used to curse, and it's just, you know. So I know stories like Florence and Judy's are preventable. With Senate Bill 5559, with people with developmental disabilities, will be given the same right that everyone in this room already has, the right to choose where they live. Senate Bill will require case managers to provide 3 choices in residential placements when going to comprehensive care or transferring into another home. This ensures that the people will be able to choose where they want to live and empower people with developmental disabilities to take control of their lives. Please support Senate Bill 559.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monica Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Carol Conlon. I reside in the city of Grants Pass. I'm the mother of 3 adult children and grandmother to 4 grandchildren. I'm a parent support service provider for my 32-year-old son who lives with me in my home. I am here today to ask for your support on Senate Bills 559 and 564. In the year 2000, I began a long and tedious journey of trying to access adequate services for my son. After 7 years and over $6,000 in legal fees, we were finally able to secure additional funding for my son's support needs. This was a difficult, time-consuming, and contentious process that I would hope could be avoided for people with developmental disabilities and their family providers. Starting in 2007, After my difficult journey trying to access more services for my son, I began my work as an advocate, helping other family providers navigate the DD system. I felt a sense of obligation and determination to push through this unnecessarily complicated and inconsistent system. In my 6 years of advocacy, I have met too many families that were told by the brokerage no more funding was available to meet their child's higher support needs. Families are told that they can receive a temporary increase in funding, but only if they declare a crisis and say they can no longer meet their child's needs. There is no path to more permanent funding above the cap. How would you feel if you were given the choice? Either tell the county you can no longer care for your child in the hopes of getting additional short-term services, or refuse to say you can no longer care for them because you know that is not true, but with the knowledge that they will have unmet support needs. This choice is fundamentally unfair and wrong. Forcing parents to declare that they can no longer care for their children just so their children can get the services they need is profoundly traumatic. So much so that often years later, family providers still cry when they tell me their stories about this choice. We need to move away from the current system that limits the support services people with developmental disabilities can receive at home. We can and must do better. Senate Bill 564 is a step in the right direction. It will remove the current arbitrary cap on support services, enabling Oregonians with developmental disabilities to maintain more independence by choosing to live at home as long as the cost of the home care is less than the cost of comprehensive out-of-home care. Senate Bill 564 is a win on two fronts. Win one, more choice for people with developmental disabilities and honoring their right to live in the least restrictive environment possible. Win two, keeping people in lower cost services like the brokerage when possible and not forcing them into unnecessary higher cost options. I also want to speak to the importance of Senate Bill 559, which would provide more choice for consumers served in out-of-home comprehensive settings like foster homes and group homes. In my work with other families in the Grants Pass area, I have heard many concerns about consumers entering out-of-home comprehensive services because family providers and consumers were scared that consumers will be given no choice in where to live. After the frustrating experience of trying to maneuver the DD system, family providers like me are deeply concerned with the lack of transparency and choice in out-of-home comprehensive services like group homes. We need a DD system that is more transparent. Senate Bill 559 helps move us in that direction by requiring case managers to provide people with developmental disabilities the opportunity to select from at least three placement options. This will help ensure that my son and all other Oregonians with developmental disabilities have a real voice in determining where they live and receive services. Thank you for your serious attention to these proposed changes in the Oregon DD system.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and giving your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis, Anderson, and members of the committee. My name is Mary Elizabeth Smith, and I'm here to ask for your support of Senate Bill 559. I'm a direct support provider in a group home owned by Bethesda Lutheran Communities in Portland. I have seen many people with developmental disabilities be ignored and not given a choice of where to live, and I believe this is fundamentally wrong. everyone, regardless of whether or not they have a developmental disability, should be given the right to choose where they rest their head at night. After Fairview closed in 2000, four people moved into a Bethesda group home where I worked. A fifth person was placed in there as well. None of these five people were given a choice of where to live or which roommates they could live with. In fact, some of the individuals had behaviors that negatively impacted the other residents, causing them distress. All of these people were nonverbal and could not self-advocate. However, the staff who supported them, including me, became adept at communicating with them and could decipher what they wanted and how to better serve them. Last year, Bethesda decided to close down this particular home. Bethesda had managers of other residential facilities come in and interview the people living in the home to see if they wanted to come live at their facilities. However, as the people I helped support were nonverbal and these managers had never met them before, there was no real communication between them. Therefore, there was no true choice given to these people. Instead of asking staff who had provided services to them for years to help them communicate and help facilitate a real choice in where to live, these managers made the decisions for them. This was unacceptable in my eyes, almost as if they were commodities being passed around. And I hope the passing Senate Bill 559 would help prevent problems like this in the future. Senate Bill 559 would provide people with at least three choices in where to live when they enter into comprehensive care services or when they must transfer residences. Requiring that people with developmental disabilities hold on to their fundamental right in deciding where to live will help avoid improper placements and increase the happiness and stability in their lives. I hope you will support Senate Bill 559. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions? All right.
Actually, could I just ask one quick question? Mm-hmm. I'm really struck by this last testimony. And I will freely admit, I have not read every word of Senate Bill 559. I agree with it. I think it's a great idea. What I don't know if it's included, and you do, is how would the choices be developed for those residents? For example, the ones that you were talking about, in theory, they should have a case manager who would know them as well as you and the other caregivers did, but we know that the caseworkers have ridiculously high loads, and it's very hard, and they're not in day-to-day contact, so they don't learn the subtle cues that people who are nonverbal can offer. So I wonder if you could comment a little bit around ways to engage people like you who really do know and sort of best practices so that we're sure that input from the people who know these people the best really gets included as we're developing these choices.
Well, I guess the county case managers would, they would probably need to talk to direct support providers more instead of just the program managers, which is what happened. They just talked to program managers and they talk to us, but they come at certain times, you know, and I work at night, and so they don't come by at night. But I spend the most time with my clients because they were at day programs during the day whenever the people would come by, which is, it's kind of silly. And then the case managers with the company, they're totally biased, and they're not necessarily thinking of the individual's needs. So
sure. I have a suggestion. Each client has what is called an ISP, an individual support plan. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've done as an advocate is inform families that they do not have to go in and have a plan presented to them already finalized, that they can have as many people on the ISP team, whoever they want on the ISP team, and these would be people like group home staff workers who work day in and day out, or foster care providers, whoever it is. In my case, I've invited several different people that my son has in his life, in addition to myself, to be there for other aspects to bring to the table. And I think that would be a great way, because these are the people that know them, and I am developing those relationships in my community for my son, because one of the things parents of children with developmental disabilities knows is that at some point they're going to pass and their children will be left, and hopefully have advocates that will step up and speak up. And so this is my insurance to knowing that my son, will have a voice even in my absence. And so I think, and some of the group home people I've met in my area are wonderful people and truly advocates and in the vocational field, and I love seeing those people in those fields, but they need to have a part of the ISP process because they know them on a day-to-day basis.
That's very helpful. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
All right. Megan Adkin, Cheryl Cisneros, and Susan Fox. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Megan Adkins. I have provided support for people with developmental disabilities in the Portland area for 6 years. All my clients receive support so they can live independently in their community through the brokerage. I'm also currently finishing my degree in special education, and I plan to teach students in transition, where I will continue to do very similar work as I do now to encourage people with developmental disabilities to build self-advocacy and self-determination skills and to prepare for life after high school. I came here this afternoon to ask for the committee's support on the package of bills before today. As a support service provider and advocate, I feel that our state can do a better job in supporting people with developmental disabilities to live with dignity, autonomy, and choice. I know that the services I provide are invaluable to the people I work with. I see it every day in their growth as individuals and in their integration in our community. What really drives me is knowing that we are paving a path to a more inclusive society. I'm looking forward to a time when people I support are afforded the same rights as any of us and treated with respect. And that brings me here today. This package of bills will start to make some critical improvements to the DD system by increasing self-determination for Oregonians with disabilities and by ensuring people have real choice in the supports that they receive. These bills will also help create a DD delivery system that is more transparent and offers better quality services. Choosing where we live and how we participate in our communities should be fundamental rights available to all Oregonians. By supporting this legislation, you will be taking an important step toward ensuring these rights for all people with developmental disabilities. You have heard testimony on 4 different bills this afternoon. Each of these bills will play a key part in improving services for people with developmental disabilities. Right now, Oregonians with developmental disabilities who are placed in comprehensive services, either group home or foster home, have little choice about where they live and receive services. We can and we should do a better job than this. Thanks. Okay. All Oregonians should have the right to self-determination. Senate Bill 559 gives people with developmental disabilities a real voice in choosing where they live and also creates a more fair process in determining job placements. Senate Bills 640 and 641 will bring more transparency and equality to DD comprehensive services by requiring the use of uniform assessment tool. They would establish clear guidelines to meet changing service needs and make sure that transparent information on service rates are made available to the people receiving services, their family members, and their service providers. People with developmental disabilities and their support service providers should expect the delivery system is transparent and fair, whether they are served in their home or in comprehensive services. I want to end by talking about Senate Bill 564, which creates a pathway to better serve people receiving brokerage services. Brokerage services offer Oregonians with developmental disabilities the opportunity to live in their own home and to direct their support services. Living in their own home allows brokerage customers to increase their self-determination through community inclusion, job development, and related skills building and support needs that promote their independence. Right now, support services for Oregonians with developmental disabilities who choose to live at home are capped at about $22,000 a year. Through my work in this field, I've heard the stories of numerous people with developmental disabilities being moved out of their homes and into a residential setting just because they need support services beyond $22,000 a year. This not only limits an individual's self-determination and choice, it also costs the state much more money because residential services cost an average of $60,000 a year per person. Senate Bill 564 will remove the current funding cap on support services, which will enable more Oregonians with developmental disabilities to stay and receive services in their homes. This is an incredibly exciting and long overdue step in providing people with more choice and autonomy. I appreciate the committee's time this afternoon and hope that you join me in supporting all the bills.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Cheryl Cisneros and I reside in Dallas, Oregon, Boone Polk County. And I am the mother of a 20-year-old young man who experiences autism and seizure disorders. And those seizure disorders have created some dangerous situations for our son. They're called psychomotor seizures. They're partial complex. And he actually will have episodes where he can run out into the street unaware and throw himself down. Other people in the community are in danger when these episodes occur. They're completely not in his control. And so because of those seizures that he experiences, we've had a number of real near misses with him. My husband and he had to roll out in the middle of the street at one point and to avoid being hit by a car. I've had a number of those instances myself. So our family approached the county DD services, and we were told that we could receive crisis services for a short period of time, which we did. And then, due to our son's intensive needs, he receives in-home comprehensive services. And there's a few things I wanted to clarify today from the testimony that's been mentioned. Our son receives in-home comprehensive services, and he chooses to live in our home with us as part of our family. Those services are called supported living services. Those are not defined in Senate Bill 564 at all. They're not defined clearly, and I think that they really need to be. With those in-home comprehensive services, he does have the right to live and remain in our family home. He does receive intensive services. In fact, he just had a CIS, the one that the supports intensity scale that's been talked about by Mike and the senators earlier. And he was rated, I was surprised, but he was rated at the 90th percentile for intensity of support needs due to these seizure disorders and all of his other complex needs. And so that he does have a high level of support. He requires 2-to-1 support in the community for his safety and for others. He requires daily living supports at home, that he doesn't want mom standing next to him all the time. He wants someone like Megan standing next to him instead. You don't want mom all the time. So it allows him some independence and having these support systems. So I wanted to clarify, supported living services are part of the comprehensive service package. They do allow our son to stay at home, and he does have that choice. So that's a really important factor. I also wanted to clarify something that one of the senators mentioned in the testimony on 564. The original bill drafted mentioned that a person could only live in their home, choose to live in their home or their family's home if the costs were less than residential supported services. That, and I was surprised to hear the senator testify that that was still the intent of the bill. That takes away our son's personal and civil liberties. If it is based on cost, that he can only choose to live at home because of a cost factor, thus taking away his personal freedoms and his personal rights as a U.S. citizen. And that very much concerns me. I know that there are some amendments to the bill being proposed. I believe that Megan actually is working on some of those. But, and she's working with colleagues of mine, and I support that effort, but I do feel that there's a lot more work to be done on clarifying the language in the bill, because there's just too much at risk with language that's unclear at this point. So I support the concepts of all of these bills, but 564 has a lot more work to be done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Good afternoon, Chair Montanos, Anderson, and the members of the committee. My name is Susan Fox. My sister and I operate at adult foster care in Multnomah County.
My district, by the way.
in Gresham. And I serve people with developmental disabilities. I'd like to take some time today to share my story about a lady that lives in my home. Sorry. I'm speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 640, sorry, which is very needed. I've been a foster care provider for 14 years. Over the years, I've seen many changes that have concerned me regarding the crisis-driven nature of the way somebody gets funding for whatever their needs are. I've seen that happening a lot in my foster home. The young lady that I'd like to tell you about, she's in a wheelchair. She can't lift her arms. She can't lift her legs. She's got the most beautiful eyes. She's high functioning. She knows what's going on. She knows what's happening to her. She has a disease that's only going to get worse. And she doesn't like her vocational site because they can't meet her needs anymore at the funding that the state has approved for her, which is, I mean, we do all of her ADLs for her. And they can't remember to change her at work. They are assigned for 2 outings a month with her. They should be something that she can participate in. And they chose a couple of weeks ago to take her to a bar and have her play pool, where she can't even lift her arms to play pool. She screamed the whole time she was there. It was right next door to their facility. They refused to take her back to the facility. And she's in such turmoil. This has been going on for 2 years. She's wanting to move. And they told me from the DD office that I work with, they told me I had to give her a 30-day notice. And no longer can you revoke that before the person has moved out of your home. She wants to stay in my home. I want to keep her in my home. And although I don't think that all of the... I think that we need to find a better way to help her. The second thing they told me to do was take her to an attorney that helps people with developmental disabilities and see if they can help her try to get the funding to ensure that she should have the right to choose where she works. It's not work. It's an ATE program. It's alternative to work. And she wants to work. It would have to be hand over hand with her. And she said she would do that just to get out of this place. This place has been really hard on her. She's been with them for 13 years. And they don't care about her. And I don't know, I just think that there needs to be more out there for them. And I really hope that you support bill number 640. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for coming and for sharing your stories. It just puts real people to the policy that's before it.
Slow down. You okay? You
all right? I'm fine. Just need to go file my story.
Okay. Did she trip?
Yeah. It gets tight back there sometimes.
Thank you. Okay, no further questions. Thank you very much, panel. And let's call Rick Rose and Aaron Witsit.
Oh, yeah. cruise through.
Five. Yeah.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Rick Rose. I have been an adult foster home provider for people with developmental disabilities in Warrenton, Oregon for over 6 years. I am deeply committed to the individuals I serve in my foster home and would like to see a delivery system that better supports their diverse needs. I am here today to ask for your support on Senate Bill 640 and 641. Currently, developmental disability services use two different assessment tools to determine the support needs and monthly service rates for people with developmental disabilities. Clients served in foster homes are assessed using an instrument called the SNAP, while clients served in group homes or receive employment services are assessed using a different instrument called the SIS. The SIS tool is used across the nation, while the SNAP was built by staff in Oregon's DD services. I would like to share with the committee my experience of how the SNAP and SIS tools result in very different outcomes and how this disparity doesn't best serve our clients. One of these residents in my foster home, I'll call him John, for confidentiality purposes, also received employment services. So John was assessed using both the SNAP tool and the SIS tool. John's assessment with the SNAP tool indicated that there was no requirements for one-on-one staff supports for his time in the community. Then the SIS tool was used to assess John's for his employment service. It was determined from the SIS assessment that John should in fact have one-on-one staff support anytime he is in the community. So coming out of this, the SIS assessment, John's care plan, called the ISP, was changed to require one-on-one staff supports anytime he's in the community. Frankly, I was very confused that the two tools would result in such different outcomes. I asked my local case manager what this meant. I was told I would now be required to provide one-on-one staffing for John in the community. I tried to raise concerns that now how his plan, the ISP and the SNAP assessments, didn't match. I requested that a new SNAP assessment be completed to reflect the new one-on-one staff hours, but I was denied this request and told that they were only doing reassessments every 5 years. It seems unfair that I am being required to provide a higher level of staffing without receiving the extra resources. I also worry that if I was no longer able to provide services for John, his SNAP assessment wouldn't reflect his correct support needs and individual budget amount. How many other clients out there do not have accurate assessments and are receiving fewer resources than they should? We must do better as a state. Senate Bill 641 will begin to address these issues by requiring DD services to use one uniform assessment tool, no matter where a person lives. Senate Bill 641 requires a uniform assessment tool that is based on national best practices and will create an advisory committee for such a tool consisting of service providers like me, people with developmental disabilities, and their advocates. This bill will pave the way for people with developmental disabilities to receive the services they require and to be accurately assessed by an evidence-based assessment tool. This bill would ensure that people like John would no longer have such disparities between his ISP and rate assessment, and that services providers would easily provide quality and appropriate services. Senate Bill 640 would also help address these issues by establishing clear, consistent guidelines for when reassessment should be completed before the five-year period. I hope you will all support both of these important bills. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Witsit. I am a DD provider for two adult foster homes in Douglas County. I'm coming to you today in support of Senate Bill 641. I currently care for eight individuals in two homes with a wide range of developmental disabilities. Our goal with our homes is to give residents a safe and normal life by providing the supports and life skills needed so one day hopefully they may be able to move out on their own. I have participated in both SNAP assessments, tools used by adult foster care, and the SIS assessment tool used for group home clients. The SNAP tool does a good job at assessing the needs of such as toileting, medical needs, their ADLs, but falls short when dealing with behavioral issues. Behavioral issues are where my staff and I spend most of our time. The SIS assessment is more comprehensive in assessing assistance needed for ADLs as well as behavioral issue. A uniform system needs to be utilized for all clients enrolled in developmental disability service programs to ensure quality care and fairness across the board. I have a resident that came to us with very few medical issues but has multiple behavioral issues. These issues include running away in the middle of the night and participating in risky behaviors with our local homeless population. This person requires constant verbal redirection and will try to assault other residents and staff on occasion. A SNAP assessment was done shortly after the person moved in. Over time, we found that this person required more support, such as one-on-one time in the community. When we asked about a new SNAP, we were told, quote, you get paid enough for that person. We asked to get a copy of the SNAP and were refused. We don't know which services that we provide are being compensated for and which services are not. We have an example of a budget summary. Megan, get to you. And on that, all we see is the base rate and the total. We don't get anything in between showing what services are paid for. See, I continue to support this individual and pay what I can for the extra staffing out of pocket because it's the right thing to do. However, this person is not receiving all the supports necessary or desired, especially when it comes to community inclusion. If this person had received a SIS assessment when called for rather than a SNAP, all their needs would be considered and not just some. See, prior to becoming an adult foster care adult foster home provider, I worked in for 6 years in group homes. Many of the residents that I cared for would be great candidates for adult foster care. In fact, I currently care for an individual that has a similar diagnosis and similar issues as to one I cared for in a group home. When comparing the similar care needs for these individuals, the group home would receive approximately $3,000 more per month than what I received for a similar individual. This disparity in rates between clients is based on the type of home and not the services needed, and is very disheartening to both me and some of the other care providers I have spoken with. Senate Bill 641 will begin to address these concerns by requiring the use of a uniform assessment tool in DD services, and will also create more transparency around rates so that providers and clients and their families can better understand how the monthly service rate is connected to what services are expected to be provided. Thank you for your time, and again, I encourage all of you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 641.
Thank you for coming, and I'm really glad that these bills are being brought forward. Thank you. We have two more people signed up, Sarah Jane Owens and Bob Dundep.
Just kind of in the interest of time, we will be submitting written testimony.
That's Sarah Jane?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Dundep from Disability Rights Oregon. And in the interest of time, I will keep my remarks brief. We support the goals of these bills. We think there's some more technical work to be done on parts of them, and we're looking forward to working to achieve some amendments that will address those. Thank you.
Oh, well, that was short. Okay.
I'm happy to go on at length. Okay.
Well, you will have opportunity, I'm sure, Bob.
What I would like to ask, Megan Moyer has come forward, and so you have heard the testimony, Megan, and if you will work with the agency and with Bob Jundiff, and I assume Sarah Jane, do you have issues to work with them on amendments? And we only have, it needs to be done quickly because we only have a couple of weeks before we need to get the bills out of the Senate over to the House.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator of the members of the committee, we do have, Megan, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union. We do currently have some amendments that have been submitted, but look forward to continuing the conversation to make sure that they encompass everything that they need to have.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and thank you everyone for coming.
Yay.
And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 559, Senate Bill 564, Senate Bill 641, and Senate Bill 640, and we're adjourned.
Good, just in time to get to my next meeting.